Okay, so sanity check. It's progression. So remember, we talked about this idea that strips actions are represented essentially at the propositional level. You could also represent actions at the atomic level, where essentially you just think of them as a state by state matrix, right? Now, obviously, when you're doing something at the propositional level, you are doing equivalently something else at the state level. Okay, so if I'm doing progression on the normal state, strip states, then what I'm really doing at the atomic level is finding a single path corresponding to the initial state, starting from the initial state, ending in any one of the states. That's a goal state. Okay, do you understand that? So for example, the way the progression is essentially working is you start, you know, if you think of the true transition graph, which is like S1, S2, S3, S4, S5, S7, S9, let's say something like that. So presumably I'm starting with S1 and I have somehow decided that either of these are goal states, because when I have a partial description of the goal state, in essence, I'm saying any one of them. If you reach any one of them, I'm done. Okay. So what happens in progression is I'm essentially trying to find one path when I'm doing search in the progression. That's basically what I'm doing. And the termination check says if I'm here or here, stop. Right? What is regression doing? If you think of regression in the context of atomic graph, I mean the transition graph, this is basically the transition graph, because this is state, and so these are all labeled edges. So it's saying if you do this action, you'll get to this state. There may be multiple, you know, edges with the same label. That's always possible, right? So what exactly? So that somebody seems to have an answer as to what the answer is for that. I know, but no, all I am saying is, in this sort of a scenario, if I'm doing regression, what exactly would I be doing on this graph? So I know that regression is a simple search, right? In the sense, I'll start with something like P and Q, and then I'll regress over an action A1 here, A2 here. So it looks like it's just a simple search tree here, just like progression. But clearly, when I'm doing that, I must be doing something equivalent here. What am I doing? So, yeah. So, who wants to elaborate? That's sort of on the right direction. So, in essence, regression in this particular problem starts with both S5 and S9 together, because that's your goal, right? The goal is any one of these states, and starts essentially finding paths parallelly from there until any one of the paths reaches S1. Do you see what I'm saying? So this is why, in some sense, regression can be thought of as a sort of a lifted search. You know, what would have been multiple parallel searches in the atomic level is basically a single search, I mean single path in the propositional level. And this is sort of what happens when you go off the representation expressiveness. You know, what you're doing as a single line of reasoning corresponds to essentially doing multiple parallel lines of reasoning at the same time. Okay. Now, of course, you can also think of this. So if you must look at what is happening to regression in this transition graph, the only way to interpret it is that it's really looking at parallel paths at the same time until any one of those parallel strands end up in the initial state. Another way of looking at it is that you can say that really regression, so if you look at it this way, it looks as if regression is doing something better than progression. Basically, it's looking at multiple things at the same time, so it should do well. So this interpretation makes you feel that regression should do well, in fact. Okay? But you can also look at regression in a different way, which is that think of, if this is the set of states, you could think of regression as doing search in the space of sets of states. right? So in essence, it starts with a single state called S5, S9, and it does one action, it becomes another single state, which just this state happens to be a set of states. If you view it this way, it looks as if regression should be killing you, because instead of doing search in a 2 power n space, I mean, instead of doing search in the space of the number of states, you're now doing search in the space of 2 power the number of states. The reason you think it will still be better is because, remember, when was the last time you thought of doing search in the space of states? I mean, space of sets of states rather than single states. What? Yes, vacuum cleaner problem. When we did vacuum cleaner problem, why exactly did we look at sets of states? Lack of observability. So the initial state did not have complete information. So it turns out that you can think of doing search in the space of sets of states. And in fact, the sets of states are called belief states. So if you think you're currently in one of these five states, then your belief state is that I'm in one of these states. If you have complete observability, your belief state would be a singleton. That means you know which state you are in, right? If not, then you essentially have a set of states. So it looks as if if you start with the initial state which is incompletely specified and you want to think about searching from there, you would be searching in the space of sets of states. That would be, when you do that, you expect that life would be harder or easier? Harder, because you have no eyes. I mean, you cannot see the initial state, and so you expect the search to be harder. Whenever you search in larger space, search should be harder. But what I'm doing with regression is, in essence, I'm searching in a larger space, too. And still I expect it to be easier. What's the difference? Part of the difference is if I am going from the initial state and I have a belief state, BS1, and then it becomes BSK, belief state K, before I can say I am done, I must ensure that every one of the states in this belief state is a goal state. Look at the vacuum cleaner example. So it should reach a belief state where every one of the states corresponds to all rooms are clean. The only way they can change is which side is the vacuum cleaner, which is in the room 1 or room 2. Do you understand what I'm saying? So you are herding cats here, cats being states, and all the cats must reach their cages when you go this side. When you come this side, you are herding cats here. I mean, actually, in some sense, you are not herding cats. You are basically sending multiple birds, and if one bird reaches the initial state, you are done. Same search space, different termination criteria. Do you see this? I mean, again, it puts a bridge from what we did in the first two classes to what we're doing now. And, you know, you have to make those kinds of connections, essentially. Okay, regression is searching in the space of belief states, and yet we expect it to be cheaper, and the only reason we expect it to be cheaper is because the termination condition says if any one of the guys you're betting on has reached the initial state, you're done. Whereas that's not enough if you're going this way. You have to make sure that every one of the states has reached the initial, reached the goal state. Okay? Okay, so that's something that you just want to keep in mind, and that also sort of gets us to something that I was asking you to think of in the thinking cap questions, which is what happens if you have conditional effects. What happens if you have conditional effects? And let me write down a really ugly looking conditional effect action. Okay, that's this action which says I have an action A and it has the following conditional effects. If L is true, then it will delete Q. If U is true, it will give P. If J is true, it will delete Q. If R is true, it will give B. Right? That is the conditional effect. Okay? If it is a normal action, then essentially there are no conditional. Here this action has no normal preconditions at all. I just basically ignored all the normal preconditions. But you know, in normal sense, in a general case, you can also have some preconditions here, you know, W and M could be the preconditions of this action. So before you can even do this action, W and M must be true. And after you do this action, depending on which of these are true in the previous state, these will be true in the next state. Okay. Now, conditional effects, I think I try to argue in that thinking cap question that conditional effects help you essentially write down a single action instead of writing many, many different actions. Right? So, for example, if you have a flight which takes off from here and goes to San Francisco, it has a conditional effect that everybody who is in it will be in San Francisco. Okay, and if you don't want to write a conditional effect, then you have to write one flight action for every configuration of passengers in the plane. Do you understand what I'm saying? So there is a flight action which involves Rao and Tom and John going, which requires all of them are present in the plane to begin with, and which will ensure that they're all in San Francisco. Right? Okay, whereas I could have just said, the plane takes off whether Rav is in or not, whether Tom is in or not, whether John is in or not. But when it reaches San Francisco, Rav would be in San Francisco if he was in the plane to begin with. Right? So one action in written with conditional effect corresponds to essentially an exponential number of actions without conditional effect. An exponential number of actions without conditional effects. So in this particular case, I have to basically, since L, U, J, and R wind up being important, so you have to consider 2 power 4 words, L, U, J, and R being true, all true, one is true, the other are false, etc., etc. And each one of them, you will have to write a different action template. That way you can avoid doing conditional effects. Okay? So basically, I would say that if you're thinking about conditional effects, here are atomic actions, which basically it's the same size for each action in a state-to-state mapping. And then above it is normal strips actions. And above that is conditional actions with conditional effects. So expressiveness is in some sense improving. You're able to say more actions with one template, more transitions with one simple template. Okay, so it turns out that it's kind of useful to use conditional effects in doing search. The question then is, which of the two searches you looked at, regression and progression, which of them is going to be affected in what way? In fact, first of all, what's our intuition as to who would be affected more? Imagine again, you know, the normal planning, the one that we are looking at where initial state is complete and goal state is partial. And that's supposed to be good because goal state is partial means I don't need it, you know, I would be considering, that's like less demanding because any one of the complete states consistent with the goal specification would be goals. Okay, so the question is, which of the searches, the progression or the regression, would be easier? Progression, okay? Because progression already knows exactly the values of each of the variables. Okay, so basically to do progression, I would have told you, I have a flight which has Rao on it, Tom on it, John is not on it, Mary is not on it, and you know, Bill is on it. That's what it would have said. For every object in the world, it would have said exactly whether it's on the plane or not. That's how it becomes a complete state. Once that it says that, then this is just a shorthand notation. You could easily say that, yeah, for L, since L is true, I'll add not Q here. U is not true here, so I won't add P there. Do you see what I'm saying? Handling conditional effects is extremely easy in progression. Nothing changes, really. because conditional effects require what is, you know, basically are asking you what is true before you started, and progression tells you what is true before you started. It gives you complete information. Now, of course, this won't be the case if, in fact, the initial state is incomplete to begin with. In which case, in essence, you have a set of complete states and you have to progress both of those states, I mean all of those states over this action. But I won't talk about that now. Let's think of the simple scenario where initial state is complete, goal state is partial. Now, as far as the regression is concerned, that's a trickier issue. Okay? That's a trickier issue because suppose I have this action, right? And I need to regress it. I mean, I have my goals are P and Q. I want to regress this state over this. The requirements are still the same. The action should do something useful and shouldn't do anything harmful. Right? Do no harm first and then at least do something useful. To say do no harm, okay, so let's say I want basically to support P. Okay, one of the interesting things is if it wasn't conditional, then you would know what the action is giving and what it's taking away. Here actually I get to decide, because it's all conditional effects, I get to decide how to whether to use this action to make P true or Q true. Right? Okay. In this particular case, it turns out that this action only gives P. It would never have given not Q any. It would never have given Q anywhere. Right? So I have to use it only to support P. But then I can support P either by making this support P or making this support P. Right? I have two conditional effects to support P. So to make P cause P, what I need to do is if this is supporting P, then I need U. If this is supporting P, I need R. Since only one of these need to support P, what I really need here is URR. Okay? Disjunction. Right? And similarly, neither of these guys should kill Q. None of them should kill Q. So this should not kill Q, so I need not L. This, by the way, has a beautiful terminology. So there is what you're doing here is your causation. You're causing this action to make P true. In order to convince that it should give P true, you have to give it either U or R. That's why I put those here. That's the bribe you have to give the action to get R out. I mean, get P out of it. Now this other one essentially is it's going to threaten to remove Q. Q is one of the goals that you need, and it's threatening to remove Q. Okay, you can't just say, well, I'm not using those effects, I'll just leave it alone, right? Because I could have come to this state with L being true, in which case not Q would be made true. As George Bush was saying, that, you know, you can't just leave possible threats alone. You have to go to their home and, you know, confront them. Okay? And so, in fact, this, surprisingly enough, is called confrontation. You want to confront these two guys and say, you better not do what you think you're trying to do. Okay? Don't give us not Q. To stop you from giving us not Q, I will make sure that you won't give us not Q by saying either not L. So to stop this, I need not L here. To stop this, I need not J here. Now the question is not L and not J, is this a disjunction or a conjunction? It's a conjunction. You have to kill all your enemies and need at least one friend. That's the way the world works, right? So essentially, in this case, not L, not J, U or R, and then of course this has preconditions, so W, M. This is going to be the state in which you will regress now. What's interesting about this state is that. So essentially this state is a partial state, but unlike previous ones where it was always a conjunction of literals, and so there are only 3 power n of them, I would essentially say that this state is any formula that can be written in terms of CNF clauses. Any formula that can be written in terms of CNF clauses. What are the number of formulas that can be written as CNF clauses in propositional logic? The whole bunch of them. Every random formula can be written as a CNF clause. And how many clauses are there? I mean, how many formulas are there in propositional logic? 2 power n. So that's the answer to your zeroth and the third question. Okay? Basically, what was happening is you are getting by with 3 power n, but there is a 2 power n that you can get back once you start using conditional effects. And if this is not confusing enough, then I'll say that if all you need is this, you can always, and you know that the initial state is complete, finally initial state is complete, then I can always split the disjunction into search space. You can always split the disjunction into search space as long as the initial state is complete. Right? So even though I have this, I can now split it into not J, not L, U, W, M on one side, and not J, not L, R, W, M on the other side. And one of them will reach the goal state. This only works because of the special case where the initial state is complete. If the initial state was incomplete, which would happen if you have partial observability, then you can't do this, and you would indeed be searching in the space of all sets of states. Okay? Any questions? Okay. So the interesting thing, of course, is the regression does change a little bit, and it has nicely causation and confrontation. And then after doing that, you can, if you don't like formulas, you can always split them into the search space. Okay. Now when you split into the search space, does complexity go away? No, it just goes into the search space. And I already told you why regression is supposed to be better, because it corresponds to a set of states. Any one of them reaches the initial state, you're done. You don't need all of them to reach the initial state. Right? Okay. So that's basically sort of a discussion of some of the things from the thinking cap thing. One more thing will come during the class. But let me now just repeat what I said last class about planning graph. You have this cake thing, and then you can draw a planning graph like this, right? And then that can be really seen as an approximation of the full progression tree, right? And if you didn't like this, this is one of the smallest examples that he could write, where he could write a little picture on the textbook. You know, our much simpler looking blocks world problem. Remember the, you know, there are only 2 blocks, and all I wanted was, you know, one block is being held. So, no, I think I forgot what was our goal. Let me just give me a second. That one. That was the goal state was not clear B and hand empty. That was the goal state, and only 2 blocks. Right? So if you are doing the planning graph for that, it starts looking reasonably ugly. Okay. But the point is, you don't have to do it by hand. I mean, you have to do it by hand for the homework and the tests, but your computers would be doing it very easily for you. Okay. When you're actually using these. Okay. Essentially, in this case, you know, here are all the, you know, initial state literals, and then I can add the actions that can be done, and then I can add their effects. And everything can be persisted. Okay, I'm just showing you this. You can work out to make sure that you understand that you know, you can do this yourself. And then by the second level, all things break loose. right? Because a lot more actions are applicable and more of their effects are present, and you'll notice that many things now can be made true by many, many things. Okay? And so this was also a question. One of the questions is, how far do I go? When do I stop? When is a logical place to stop? And as you, those of you who read ahead in the textbook, notice that there is a logical place to stop, which is basically when two consecutive levels don't change. So the propositions in two consecutive levels are the same, then you don't need to extend it any further because it's going to be same forever and ever. Okay, in fact, one of the interesting things about the planning graph is, ugly as it looks, it has a huge amount of structure. Okay, it has a tenure system. The moment anybody gets in, they'll never go out. Right? You know, so once a literal gets in, it'll never go out. So it just monotonically increases, keeps getting more and more literal. So at some point of time, you have exhausted all the literals. Then you can't change from, you know, and since there are only finite number of literals, if even if you change one literal per, you know, one new literal comes in per level, you would be done, you know, in finite number of layers. Oftentimes, actually, what happens is you'll be done much before that because two levels hasn't changed at all. So there are a huge number of literals that you'll never reach. And if two levels haven't changed, then there is no way that the next level will change. Right? So level of condition for planning graphs when you don't do negative interactions is check whether the proposition lists are the same in two consecutive levels. If so, stop expanding. Okay? So that's the level of condition. I won't talk about, so that's, okay, so now having said this, then I also mentioned, so in this kind of a scenario, so we could talk about one idea for heuristics, which was if I was trying to compute the heuristic value for a set of literals, okay, then let's say what are the literals I'm interested in? Not clear B and hand empty. Those are the ones I'm interested in. So I can check the levels at which not clear B and hand empty become true. Okay, so notice that not clear B comes in first time here. It's not here. Because clear B is present here, so not clear B is not present here at this point because this is an actual consistent state. In the planning graph, the only the first level is a consistent state. After that, it's not a state at all. It's just sets of states. So I have not clear B here. And then how about hand empty? Hand empty is present here itself. Right? So I can compute the distance, I mean the cost of a set. So basically I have now the situation, I have a set of literals, L1, etc., LK. I can talk about the level at which each of the ith literals become true, the first time they become true. Now then using this, I need to decide what is the level for the entire set. For the entire set. Okay, I'll give you two ideas. Idea one is take the sum of the levels at which each of the literals come in. Okay, so if this literal is 0, this is 1, 0 plus 1 is my sum. And if, you know, two literals, one of them is 3, one of them is 5, 3 plus 5, 8 is my sum. Okay, that's one idea. This is called the H-sum heuristic. The other idea is take max of the levels at which any of the literals, so the last arriving literal, that's the guy who you are looking at. Because of the tenure system, anybody who came in earlier is still hanging around. So the last guy comes in, now the bus can start. Right? So you take the max. Okay, back to A star search. Which of these heuristics is actually admissible and which is not? Or is are both admissible? Max is definitely admissible. How about sum? Sum is not admissible. Basically, what sum requires actually is that all the goals be independent. all the goals be independent. So in fact, from the view of planning graph, from the view of planning graph, you can actually talk about this notion of goal interaction. And a set of goals can be independent, purely independent, can be positively interacting, and can be negatively interacting. The idea is that if goals are independent, that means you make one true in one way, another true in another way, you can just concatenate them, and it will make both of them true. They don't have anything in common with each other. Okay, if goals are actually independent, then H sum would be admissible. Now, if some of your goals are independent, but some are positive, some are negative, then H sum won't be independent, H sum won't be admissible. And the admissibility goes because of what reason, which of these, the positive or the negative interaction. By the way, positive means the two goals help each other. So if you need 5 steps to achieve goal 1, 7 steps to achieve goal 2, then the sum of the plan for achieving goal 1 and goal 2 is less than 12 steps. So somehow some things can be kind of used for both the goals. Negative means the opposite. You can't make this goal. If you make this goal, then you need to do more to make this goal. The worst case negative interaction, the worst case positive interaction is you make one goal true, the other goal is true, just as a side effect. The worst case negative interaction is what? You make one goal true, you can never make the other goal true. It's like, you know, my two goals are A and not A. Okay, and so what happens when you consider H sum is basically H sum would be admissible as long as sub goals are independent. And it will also be admissible if the sub goals are either independent or negatively interacting. It becomes inadmissible when there are positive interactions. Okay. Now, what about informedness? H sum is the perfect heuristic when the goals are independent. But the numbers it gets can be much smaller than the real number of the length of the plan required when there are negative interactions. So the ideas that we were thinking about, like admissibility is connected to positive interactions in planning. And negative interactions are connected to informedness. Right? If you think of the H star, informedness is how close do you get to it. Admissibility is do you ever cross it. Right? So again, another connection across many weeks to a star search. Okay, so H sum is going to be, and since normally when you're given a bunch of goals upfront, you would not know whether they're independent or positively interacting or negatively interacting. So some subset might be independent, some subset are positively interacting, some are negatively interacting. So H sum cannot be guaranteed to be admissible. H level, on the other hand, can be guaranteed to be admissible. H sum, however, if you are trying to get done with your project, which one are you going to use? H level is admissible, but its informedness sucks because it's assuming there are no negative interactions whatsoever. Okay, so it's a little better than H equal to 0, but nowhere near perfect. Okay, so here basically is kind of an idea that an example. Where I'll give you two examples where in one case H sum is better than H level and in the other case H level is better than H sum. Okay, so in this scenario I have 100 goals P1 to P100. In this scenario, each one of the actions gives one of the goals. Right? So the length of the plan to get all the 100 goals, according to you, is what? 100. What does H lev say? 1. 1 is less than 100 in case you haven't checked, right? Whereas what does H sum say? 100. So in this case, advantage H sum. Right? How about this side? There is B star, one guy which gives all the 100 goals at the other extreme. In this case, what does H sum say? 100. And what does H lev say? 1. And H sum is like way out of being admissible. Right? Right? So my question, we haven't actually, in either of these, have I considered negative interactions? No. I am only considering positive interactions. Where did I consider positive interactions? This one. Because the way of making P1 true also makes P2 true and P3 true, etc. This is the extreme case of positive interaction. Sometimes, you know, half of the work you did in making P1 true is also useful for making P2 true. That's still positive interaction. Now it turns out that there is a simpler idea which is better than either of these, which is look at this and say, look, I want P1 to P100, right? And I have a graph structure here. Why can't I say, you know, mark all these guys from the previous level, pick at least one action to support each of them, and then if you pick an action, then make sure that their preconditions are supported in the previous level. I'm doing planning. I'm supporting things with actions, right? Except this is not full planning, this is relaxed planning, because we don't consider negative interactions. We're assuming that everybody will get along with everybody. It's just a question of taking the right smallest subset. If I do that, the relaxed plan length here would be, I would need one guy to support each of them, so there are going to be 100 edges. That means all these 100 actions will come in, but then all of their preconditions are empty, so in fact nothing else comes in. So my relaxed plan is a subgraph of the planning graph, and if you add up the actions, count the number of actions in the relaxed plan, that is 100. In this case, it's 1. Okay, so what I would suggest is, let's not do H sum or H level, do H relax, which basically, just as before, it would come up to this point, and then let me see if I can find you the slide. It's actually here. So that this is the same thing that you saw earlier, except in a smaller form. I basically mark the two things that I want, and then mark, you know, basically consider somebody to support each of them, and if I take somebody from this level, then I take their preconditions from the previous level and recurse. This is a backtrack-free search, because you'll never have to say, I can't use this action, because every action gets along with everybody. Not because they really do, but because you decided to ignore negative interaction. Right? And so this greedy search will find you the plan, which would have worked if nobody had any negative interactions. And you then count the number of actions in that plan and use that as the heuristic value. That is the state of art currently, one of the best heuristics. Okay. Now, here is the question. Is this idea of relaxed plan, is that admissible? Is that admissible? Notice that all I can say is I don't have to backtrack, because any set of actions I pick can be done together, so I will get a feasible plan that would have worked if there are no negative interactions. But would it have been the smallest such plan when there are no negative interactions? That's not guaranteed. If you really want the smallest plan when the world doesn't have negative interactions, then you have to backtrack. You have to essentially find the optimal subgraph of this graph which supports all these guys. That, in case you haven't figured out by now, would be NP-complete. However, if you are only interested in finding a plan, a reasonable quality plan, then relaxed plan actually would be a great approach to use compared to HSAM and H-level. It won't give you optimal plans. Finding optimal plans with relaxed plan means you have to first find optimal relaxed plan, which is NP-hard to begin with. Okay? So that's basically the issue about relaxed plan. And then, you know, all you do for relaxed plan is you take things, you know, you mark the goals in that last level and then pick anybody to support them and do the greedy check. For example, if you pick somebody to support this guy and if that person, that action is also giving this, use that itself. Don't pick another guy. That way you will get the smaller relaxed plan. It won't be the smallest because I can always construct a scenario where things look fine until the last minute when, in fact, the number of actions will increase. And so you would have to backtrack at that time. Okay, finding an optimal plan would require optimal relaxed plan, which will involve search even if there are no negative interactions. But just finding a relaxed plan, a reasonable quality relaxed plan, is not going to be hard. Okay? So this basically summarizes whatever I just said. There is HLEV, there is HSAM, there is HRELAX. HLEV and HSAM have their, you know, competing advantages. HRELAX tries to combine them. HRELAX unfortunately is not admissible like HLEV. Okay? But basically it does a good job in practice in finding reasonably good quality plans. Okay? So this is basically the animation of what happens if you're doing progression. For each of these guys, you will construct a separate planning graph. And so for each of these children states, you have constructed a planning graph, and you do a relaxed plan on all of them, right? And find the length of the relaxed plan. That would be the H value for this, that, for that, for that. That's what you do when you do progression, okay? That's the picture. That this is also something that I mentioned last time. So when you're doing progression, for each of the children states, you have to construct a planning graph and then find the relaxed plan on them, because we now know that relaxed plan is the better way to go. For regression, you just construct one planning graph and just keep finding the relaxed plan on that. And as I mentioned at the end of last class, you know, anybody with any ounce of common sense would say, yeah, I think this should work much better than this, and that's the mistake. It turns out this works better still. Okay, I can go into details as to why that is the case, but suffice it to say that nobody expected it. You know, it's easier to explain something than to expect something, right? I mean, if we knew how to expect something, then we wouldn't have mucked around with Earth-centric, planetary model. We tried to keep explaining, you know, planetary models, still keeping Earth in the middle somehow, and then when it became too darn hard, then we said, yeah, okay, we'll agree that somebody else is in the middle, right? It's possible to actually explain what's happening, but, you know, the community itself was surprised that regression didn't work as well as progression, given all the interesting properties regression has. Okay? Okay. The last thing I want to do before I move on from planning is connected to something in the thinking cap questions, which you guys also looked at, right? Which is, what if actions have costs? Okay, if nothing else changes, but now actions have costs. Right? What do I do then? If actions have costs, I can still do planning graphs. In essence, basically I have to propagate the costs over the planning graph now. And in particular, so there is a question as to if there is a P, so suppose P can be, you know, A1, somehow I needed 4 costs to get to A1 and 6 costs to get to, A3. Okay, so then the question is, what is the cost of P? What's the cost of P? So you can either make P true by spending $4 or spending $6.
The lowest way to get to P.
What?
The lowest cost
Yeah. So if there are four, if there's a $4 way and a $6 way, the real cost of P is just 4. It's the minimum of the two values. That's enough. That's easy. So basically, when I'm progressing, so when I get to the proposition level, I take the minimum of the cost of the actions that are supporting it. Easy enough. What's harder is here. Now this action has P with a 4 supporting it and Q with a 5 supporting it. So A4 requires both P and Q. So what's the true cost of what's the true cost? And then A4 itself, just to do A4, you need to pay $3. For the privilege of doing A4, you need to pay $3. And you need to get to a place where you can do A4. So for example, for the privilege of going into Disneyland, you need to pay the admission price. But you can't just pay the admission price and sit here. You have to first go to the Disneyland, pay the admission price, and then go in. And most of the time you realize that you spend a lot more money just getting to the Disneyland than what you pay them. Right? Depending on how far you are. So this is how to get here. Plus, the privilege of doing A4 is $3. Okay? Now the question is, how much do I spend to get to P, you know, a place where P and Q are both true? P was 4, Q was 5. Is it sum? Is it max? Is it some other random number? Everything is feasible. Okay? If you want admissibility, the only thing you can do is max. If you do max, it's admissible. Okay? It will be cost optimal plans then. Okay? If on the other hand you do sum, you are likely to get bigger numbers. And you know, if heuristics are bigger, search gets done faster. I mean, it might miss a couple of solutions. Sometimes it will miss all the solutions. If the heuristic is infinity, then you will say there is no solution right away. Okay? But you know, the bigger numbers is better for the amount of search, the efficiency of search. So the temptation is to do H sum. The right thing to do if you want optimality is H max. And an even better thing to do is basically leave all these alone, and then when you really need the cost, find a relaxed plan and find its cost. That too is possible. But again, whatever I said, you can see that each of them I can spend like, you know, 20 minutes explaining how to do those details. But you can sort of understand that that should be doable based on what you know about planning graphs. Okay? One other interesting thing about this cost-oriented planning graphs is that the first time somebody comes in is not necessarily the cheapest cost. Do you understand that? The first time somebody comes in may not necessarily be their cheapest cost. Right? Because, so I'm sitting here and I'm trying to find out how to get to a state where I'm inside Disneyland, and then this travel agent says, you don't have to do anything. Just give me $1,000. You're already in Disneyland. I'll take care of everything for you. Okay? Or I can say, well, I will walk down somewhere, which will be like $1 worth of my time, then buy the plane tickets, that will be like $20 worth of the, you know, $200 worth of plane tickets, then take the cab, another $20, then go to the admission ticket, another $100. Now this turns out to be cheaper. For poor graduate, undergraduate students, this is better. For really rich people, you know, who the heck cares? You know, I just have no time to waste. Let the travel agent do it. Okay, the important point is the first time the cheaper cost comes is much farther down, because you have to do these things in a sequence, right? And so the first time you even realize that there's a cheaper way of getting into Disneyland is after you did 5 levels of projection. And then suddenly the cost went from 1,000 to maybe 350 or maybe whatever, 450. Which is a cute idea, because you know, when all actions are equally costly, then the first time somebody comes in is the easiest way to get to them. It'll never become any better. Okay? So that's basically the cost-oriented planning graph, and in fact, you know, the fact that as you keep going, so now one of the interesting questions is, when do you stop expanding the planning graph? Really, you have to stop expanding after the costs don't change. But then I already told you that the way you initialize cost itself is iffy, because you could use hmax or hsum or hrelax. So whatever way you use, you have to keep going for a while until nothing changes too much. But one of the advantages, even though it looks as if there are just so many loose ends, one of the advantages of thinking of all of these at the heuristic level is at the heuristic level you can be as lazy and as wishy-washy as you want, especially if you don't care about optimality, in which case you can be like totally wishy-washy, right? Because what happened, suppose the planning graph actually levels off, the simpler planning graph actually levels off after 10 levels or 20 levels, okay? But I don't feel like doing it. I'll just go 3 levels and I'll stop. I'll say I am leveled off. Not the planning graph, I am leveled off. I lost my patience. What happens? Nothing big. So all you will see is if in fact the things that you're looking for are not present in the third level, then you assume that they are at least four costly. At least four costly. That's fine. It's better than assuming they're zero costly, which is what h equal to zero would have assumed. Do you understand what I'm saying? So the point we are making is doing all this stuff in heuristics and keeping search, base level search, clean as you can, has the advantage that all the solutions would be sound. You'll never have to worry whether the plan is wrong. You're doing all these machinations in the heuristic level. You get to do that, especially if you don't care about admissibility. And even if you do care about admissibility, you can still get to do it, because in this case, you can take max over the conditions, for example. Okay? So this is kind of the closest connection to what we did in the beginning of the semester and now, because it's like the same ideas are coming up in a different guise, essentially. Okay? Anyway, this was what I was trying to show you earlier, but in a bigger form, but I showed it in a smaller form, that's fine. Any questions before I move on to the next topic, which I will start this week, I mean start today's class, and then we'll continue next class, and then also on Friday, probably. Okay. Any questions on this stuff? Okay. So what I'm going to do now, as I said, I mean, I don't have the slides here, but as I said, I'm going to go from propositional level all the way to atomic level now and talk about a problem that we haven't talked about till now. Okay. In fact, a version of that kind of a problem, I can already talk to you about this here. Okay. Suppose I have not only actions with costs, but I also have goals with utilities. Okay? Let's assume that they are in the same currency. Costs and utilities are in the same currency. This is not always true in the world, but let's assume, you know, everything has been converted into either dollars or yuan. You know, if China has its way, it will become yuan, right? Is it yuan, right? Chinese currency? What is it?
Yeah.
So that's what we'll, so whatever is the common currency, we'll all convert into that. Right? So the costs and the utilities are in the same currency. Right? Now, here's the interesting thing. What's the optimal plan supposed to be? What are you supposed to do? So I tell you, here are all the things you get to do for this semester. You can miss a couple of homeworks. I'm not going to kill you. Right? And then, you know, whenever you're trying to do a homework, you're missing all sorts of other fun in your life. You're not going to see games. You're not going to have life and all that stuff. And so there is cost involved. And there are benefits involved. Classical planning made it look as if every homework has to be done. Every project has to be done. There can't be any errors. If you do one error, you die. You get zero. Otherwise, you get one. But normal life is not classical planning, right? You basically, you know, many of you are still hoping that that's the case, because some of you actually didn't submit some of the homework. And you're thinking, we'll still be fine, right? And you will be fine. Right, and we make these trade-offs. We'll say, how much should I try to do? And even if I'm completing the homework, do I do everything including the extra question, or just, you know, do a couple of them and act as if I'm submitting something? It all depends on what else do I have to do. Right? So normal planning is not as simple as I made it sound like. In fact, the goals have utilities, the actions have costs. In a way, you don't really want to decide to work on each goal. You want to work on the optimal set of goals. Now, what's the optimal set of goals? Optimal set of goals are those set of goals, if you tried to achieve them, you'd have got the best net benefit. That is the sum of goals achieved minus the cost that you spent, assuming all of them on the same currency. That's, you can think of that as what's called partial satisfaction planning. Okay, so you have a whole bunch of goals, you don't have to satisfy all of them. Right? Now, partial satisfaction planning problems are in a way much easier and in a way much harder. Okay, much easier because one feasible plan for a partial satisfaction planning problem is, I don't do anything. If you don't do anything, no pain, no gain, and it all cancels out, you got zero net benefit, that's okay. In fact, some people can get negative net benefit after thinking. Right, I mean, imagine you wasted desperately trying to complete the homework. You told your girlfriend to go away, your boyfriend to go away, your parents to stop bugging you. You didn't complete the homework anyway in the end. So you're glaring at me, thinking I somehow did anything bad to you. You just did the wrong planning. Right? You should have projected yourself and realized that it's, you know, wasted effort. Might as well have fun. Right? But unfortunately, you don't know how to project. That's why you need computers to project for you. Do you understand what I'm saying? So partial satisfaction planning is closer to life. There's only one thing that's missing from partial satisfaction planning to make it completely similar to life. In fact, two things, okay? One thing that's missing is that when you are projecting what will happen if you do an action, till now we have been assuming that the actions have deterministic outcomes. The reality is, when you're thinking, okay, so now I'm sitting here, I'm looking at this homework problem, if I spend 10, 20, 30 hours staring at this, there are two outcomes that will happen. One, I would have gotten the answer. Two, I wouldn't have gotten the answer. It's a non-deterministic, it's a probabilistic action. And depending on, you know, your self-esteem and all that stuff, you assign some probabilities to this, right? Okay, so really what you need is partial satisfaction planning with stochastic action. And furthermore, if I really want to make your life happier, you could say, well, partial satisfaction planning with stochastic actions and incomplete initial state. Okay, I will not go all the way there. I will basically say that if you're trying to do partial satisfaction planning with stochastic actions, right, that the model for talking about what is the right solution for that, we haven't talked about it even at the atomic level. Okay, and that model is Markov decision processes. So that's why we will look at it, because it's closer, at the atomic level at least, it's closer to the kind of planning problems you will in fact encounter. Okay, and so you want to understand, you know, how to deal with that. And then if you want to throw in partial observability, then we'll become PomDPs, partially observable Markov decision processes. I won't touch them with a 10-foot pole in this class. But, you know, we will do it, and you can do it later on, you know, graduate level course, we might do it. Okay, so, but the point, of course, is that when you do partial satisfaction planning, even in the deterministic case, planning is no longer a feasibility problem. It's a true optimization problem. Because you can always come up with a feasible solution without thinking at all, which is do nothing. For classical planning, that's not possible, because do nothing would not have achieved all the goals. To get even a single feasible solution, you need to spend some time. And then getting the cheapest such solution will be harder. Right? And this is actually, you know, before I go into the, what if you didn't have any hard goals? That's basically what it was. I have a whole bunch of goals, and none of them really have to be done. If you don't do it, you'll take the penalty. Right? And if you do it, you'll get the reward of that goal. Okay? And get rewards continually. So that's the other interesting thing. So in fact, one of the points I made the point earlier that some of the goals can be trajectory goals. It's not necessary that all your utility comes at the very last state. You know, the whole point of, you know, stop to smell the roses is basically, you know, enjoy the journey before, you know, and just don't focus too much on the goal state alone, because that's as part of any pleasure you will get as just reaching a goal state. So you might be getting rewards continually in the general case. A special case of which is you'll only get it in the end. okay, and you have stochastic actions. If you don't have these two, it's still basically deterministic planning, but more than what we discussed. I'm adding this also, in which case there is a model called Markov decision processes, which is more than deterministic planning. And then looking at this is quite useful because it gives, you know, even understanding at the atomic level how to do it is quite interesting. It's no longer just finding a path in the space of states in the atomic level, because in atomic level for normal planning it was always just a path of, you know, path in the graph. Here it's no longer that. Okay. So in fact, one other interesting point to make is about this is those of you who are graduate students may have heard of the idea called ABD. Who have heard ABD? If you haven't heard ABD and you're doing PhDs, you're in big trouble. ABD is all but dissertation. Okay? During your graduate study, you know, at some point of time, you have completed all the courses, right? And all you have left is dissertation, which is a huge thing, but nobody is looking to see whether you're doing it every day. Okay, if you haven't done it after 20, 30 years, you are in trouble. But if you have not done much work in 1 week, that's okay. Right? Now, but that's the reality. ABD is the kind of difficulty, you know, you have in real life, which is it's unstructured. People tell you what to do and they won't keep looking at you to see whether you're doing it or not. Whereas in undergraduate course and in this grade level, in fact in the elementary school level, not only does your teacher set you goals, but they will slowly get you to the goal. They will say, you know, my son has these projects, so-called projects, you have projects, and I say, submit it on a particular day, right? My son has projects, and then his teachers basically check pretty much every day, and they meet him every day, and they check whether, okay, you have done from this line to this line, next this line to this line, they'll guide him through it. You can argue that those guys are getting on my nerves. Why don't you just leave me alone and I'll get it done for you? And that's what my son argues, and I tell him that you would miss this once you grow up. Right? Because being told, oh, you just have to do it, and you find out the way to do it is actually looks easy but is harder because you have to do the planning yourself. Whereas the poor grade school teacher is doing the planning for you and you have no respect for him or her. Not that you have any for me, but, you know, you don't have any respect for people who do planning for you, but you should, because they put structure. Okay, Albert dissertation is exactly an unstructured part of your education. It becomes the most unstructured, and so people sometimes flounder because they no longer know that anything is due. So, of course, you know, we make conference deadlines a due date. That's okay, but that's not necessarily the optimal thing to do either. Because if you're going to, you know, if I know enough and if I say that if I cross all these conference deadlines and focus on these really hard problems, I'll prove P equal to NP or not. Should I do that or should I do this? Depends, my friends, on your self-esteem. If you believe that you can solve P equal to NP, then you should be doing that. If you think you have no such hope, then you should be writing very quick workshop conference papers. Because at least that is going to get you somewhere as against zero level. Okay? So, let's go down from lofty heights to much simpler scenario where all these points are going to be made again. Okay? It's a simple planning problem. I have a start state and it's a search problem. I have a start state, right? And then I need to get to a goal state, looks like. Normally, if I just give you a start state and a goal state, it's simple. I just have to find a path through the states. Your, you know, first project would have done it. I'll make life somewhat more interesting by saying, actually, there are two sync nodes, two sync states, this state and this state. Once you reach them, you reach nirvana. You cannot do anything more after that. Okay? And then this is plus one. You get nirvana with a beatific smile on your face. This is minus one with nirvana with an inverted face. Okay? You're unhappy, but you're dead. Okay? And the other one, you're happy and you're dead. Right? And then, so now this is slightly different because you have multiple goal states with different utility values. Furthermore, what you can do, it turns out, is go up, go down, go sideways. That's the usual thing. Except, you know, because you are in a stochastic world and, you know, your legs aren't moving properly, you have this kind of a scenario. When you try to go to the neighbor in a particular direction, with 0.8 probability you will get there. With 0.1 probability you will go left, 0.1 probability you go right. So this is not as bad as can happen. In a truly non-stochastic, truly non-deterministic world, you try to do something, you can be anywhere in the world. But this one is a local stochasticity. So you will still try to get to the right place with 0.8 probability. With 0.1 you will go this side, 0.1 you go this side. Zero probability you will go backward. At least your models are not that bad. Right? So if I'm here, start, I go up, I'll go with here, to here with 0.8 probability, here with 0.1 probability, and I'll stay here with 0.1 probability. Because the assumption is when I try to go in, I'll hit the wall and stay in the room. Okay, whereas if I was here, I would have gone here with 0.1, here with 0.1, with 0.8 I would stay in. Right? Fine. Now, the next thing is, of course, this is my scenario. And then I'll also say, if I just leave this and go home, then you can basically say, I just don't even want to move. I'll just hang around here. So to make, to say, get going, I'll say every one of these states has a reward, which is a negative reward, 0.04 minus 0.04. So if you're just hanging around doing nothing, you only get, the negative reward, minus 0.04. Okay? Now the question is, what are you supposed to do in this case? It's a simple problem. What are you supposed to do? What's the solution look like for this problem? What does the solution look like for this problem? Now, I would say that essentially what you have are the probability matrix, which is basically telling you, given you do something in a state, what are the probabilities that you'll go into these other states. So this is an atomic model. So if you write state by state matrix for the action, instead of having just all zeros and just one one, you now have bunch of zeros and a bunch of numbers less than 1 such that they all add up to 1. That's what it is. So atomic representation didn't change. But the solution, on the other hand, previously used to be a single path. Now what is it? What it really is a policy. Basically, the solution should tell you, if you know where you are, what should you do? That's it. Locally, if I'm in this state, what should I do? If I'm in this state, what should I do? If I'm in this state, what should I do? Okay? Now, I would then say that a policy is really a state action mapping. Is a state action mapping. For each state, you should do an action. Right? Now, the interesting question is, in this case, how many actions do I have per state? 4. Up, down, right side, left side. Maximum 4 actions. How many states do I have? So the total number of, the maximum number of actions I can do, let's say, is the cardinality of the set A. The maximum number of, and the total number of states is S. What is the total number of policies? A policy is essentially in each state do an action. How many and a policy will change if you take one state and change the action there, so the policy has changed. So how many policies are there? So I can, the first state I can do any one of 4, next state I can do any one of 4, next state I can do any one of 4, multiply, right? So it's A in the first state times A in the second state times A in the third state, etc. Right? And so that would be, and how many are there? S states. So this is A power S policies. Is this good news or bad news? Actually good news. Okay, because it's a finite number. I mean, here is a course where you are happy just to have a number as against infinity, right? So it's only A power S policies. Now what I want to do is do the optimal such policy. Okay, one policy is basically everywhere try to go left. That's one policy. Another policy is everywhere try to go right. Okay, so what the right kind of policy, I'm sorry, right kind of policy for this problem might look like this. Okay, so if you are here, try to go this side. If you are here, try to go this side. If you are here, go up. If you are here, then go like this, etc. That's a policy. Is this actually the right kind of policy? No, this is not a right kind of policy. You see, this is not a right kind of policy, right? Because I have a plus one here and I'm saying I don't want it. So it's not a right kind of policy. The optimal policy would be something different. I'll probably be able to show you the example in a minute. But this is a policy. Now, what I want to show is, okay, this is actually an optimal policy for this particular problem. Okay, much of what we are trying to figure out is how to compute this. Okay, but before you can compute something, you should know how it looks like. If the solution comes and bites you on the hind side, would you recognize it? And if you are looking for like a single line plan, you would never have recognized this because this is a policy. That's what you need. First of all, do people realize that policy is a general case of a plan? Because a plan tells you what to do in just a subset of states. In a deterministic world, if you know the initial state and you do an action, you do the next state. And you know, do the next action, you do the third state. So if you just know what to do in all those states, you don't need to know anywhere else because you'll never get into that scenario. Right? A policy, on the other hand, is required because you have stochastic dynamics and you might go away from the expected path. And so there is a non-zero probability that you'll find yourself pretty much anywhere in the world, and so you need to know what to do if you find yourself there. Right? Okay. I want to give you, this is the last slide I want to show you, and then we'll come back and discuss more of it next week. You know, I said this is the optimal policy for the problem I gave, which is if you hang around doing nothing, you get a negative penalty of 0.04. And this is 0.8, of course, up and minus 0.1 and 0.1 each side. Okay. Now, the optimal policy obviously should depend upon the action model, the probabilities involved there. It should also depend upon the reward model. Okay. So here is the interesting thing. Suppose it looked like a very incidental detail as to what is the number I gave as the penalty for doing nothing, hanging around in a state, right? But suppose I consider this penalty in different regions like this. For states which are not goal states, which are not the sink states, suppose I say all of them have a penalty less than minus 1.62. That means it's quite negative. So minus 1.62, minus 2, minus 3, etc. Those are the values. Or between minus 0.42 to minus 0.0850. R between this to 0, R again above 0, do you have intuitions as to what's likely to happen? Let's think about what happens here. Here, the world is so painful. Just life is unbearable. You basically just hanging around, people are hitting you on the head. So you want to get out of life, either with a happy smile or a sad smile. Right? Perfect case for suicide depression victims. Right? Here, on the other hand, the world is so fun, you don't feel like dying, and so your pastor or your priest or your imam is telling you, you should do a following thing so that when you're dead, you will get somewhere, and you're saying, why the heck do I want to die to begin with? I'm having too much fun. Right? So I would expect that the optimal policy for this would be make a beeline to an exit. It doesn't matter what the exit looks like. Closest exit. The optimal policy for this would be get as far away from exits as possible. Don't look at churches, don't look at hospitals, don't look at anything which makes you think of after the life because you're having too much fun. And in between are the other things. Okay? So here, as you expect, it turns out that once you figure out how to do the optimal policy for this MDP, our solution will tell you that the optimal policy for this is this. And you notice that this guy from here is not trying to avoid minus one. He says, let me get in. You know? Right? And Here, you notice that in all the other places, they can do pretty much anything. Just anytime you think the world is about to end, get away from it. So hang around doing anything until you see a church or a hospital. Then you run away from those places. That's the optimal policy for this. And we can show that that is the case by just using our optimal policy construction method. And in between are the interesting scenarios. So this is the one that corresponds to this range, because it's 0.04 minus, and that falls in this range. And you notice that the optimal policy looks like what I have here. And this one is even more risk averse, because the life is becoming nicer and nicer. So when this guy has minus one, he said, well, I can just take a little risk and go this side. But here, life is so good, why do I want to end it? Right? So I would actually go away from it, so that the probability that I will be here and here are 0.1 and 0.1, and here will be 0.8. Whereas the opposite way, there is a 0.1 probability of being here. This is the problem we're going to talk about next class. What does it mean? First of all, you realize the optimal policies differ. The question is, how do we compute these optimal policies? Okay, and the interesting thing is, once you understand this, you can then go from there to also adversarial search, which is, for example, how does Deep Blue win against Kasparov, which is well connected to this. Okay, that's it.